From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty-four-year-old Gerald Ladd grew up in a Dallas housing project. His mother was a heroin addict, so was his grandmother. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ladd about how he escaped a similar fate. Ladd is now a contributing writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of the new memoir, Out of the Madness. Also today, restoring the lost symphonic works of stride pianist James P. Johnson. We talk with Maren Alsop about her new recording and her conducting career. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Freddie Johnston and the band Shoes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and Jordan have signed a declaration ending 46 years of hostility. Jordan's King Hussein and Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin have signed the Washington document, which paves the way for a formal peace treaty. But Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that could be months away. Both leaders shook hands warmly today at a White House ceremony. Premier Rabin says he looks forward to the day when a handshake between Israelis and Jordanians won't be unusual.
What I do wish you, Your Majesty, that there will be another day of excitement, and another, and that finally no one will photograph our handshakes. It will have become part of the routine of our lives, a custom.
King Hussein says this is a day of hope, one which he has prayed for.
For many, many years, and with every prayer, I have asked God, the Almighty, be a part of forging peace.
The new document is not a peace agreement, but both countries will begin work immediately on border issues and water rights. The Clinton administration is defending its handling of the Rwandan refugee crisis. Some relief groups are accusing the United States of waiting too long to act when more than a million Rwandans poured across their border with Zaire. Secretary of State Christopher says no one could have predicted the crisis would happen on such a huge scale. He told ABC today that the Clinton administration is trying to get the new Rwandan government to promise that it will not seek revenge against refugees who return home. The new government is dominated by the Tutsi ethnic group, while the toppled government and most of the refugees are Hutus. Attorney General Janet Reno has marked the fourth anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act by opening a media campaign. It encourages compliance with this law, which bans discrimination. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has this report.
For one out of seven Americans, equality means being able to get in the door.
The Americans with Disabilities Act is bringing down the barriers.
Reno unveiled a series of public service announcements like this one to promote a toll-free number businesses and individuals can call in order to learn more about how to comply with the law. The Justice Department is also placing informational material in 15,000 libraries across the nation.
Too many have taken a wait-and-see attitude to determine whether the Justice Department is serious about enforcing and compliance. I've got one answer. We are serious. Very serious.
Reno encouraged Congress to restore $2 million to the federal budget to pay for educational programs on the anti-discrimination law. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 6 points at 3,741. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Nearly 7,000 Los Angeles transit workers have gone on strike today. The L.A. system is the nation's second largest. Thousands of commuters are carpooling, hitchhiking, or many just stayed home. The Amalgamated Transit Union, which represents some 2,000 bus mechanics, called the walkout after it failed to clinch an agreement with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority late yesterday. No new talks are scheduled. Some 4,300 bus and train drivers and about 600 clerks are honoring the pickets. They've all reached tentative agreements with the Transit Association on their own. Nearly 1.25 million people rely on the Los Angeles MTA every day. A new report on the nation's colleges and universities finds most have survived the financial pinch of the early 1990s, but many remain in uncertain financial condition. Michael Leland reports.
The American Council on Education study of 406 institutions found most got through the past few years by reorganizing, cutting course offerings and keeping a closer eye on spending. But it found 32% of administrators say they're worried about having enough student financial aid. 24% worried about that last year. The council says most American campuses have gone over their programs to see how well each fits with the university's overall mission. Two-thirds of the schools have added programs, sometimes to increase revenue, but about half cut out some programs or courses. The report says this all means some students will find fewer course offerings and fewer services, but that colleges and universities will be leaner and meaner heading into the 21st century. I'm Michael Leland in Washington.
A private realtors group says rising interest rates are putting a damper on sales of previously owned homes. The National Association of Realtors says sales fell about 3.6% in June. That's the second straight monthly decline. Mortgage rates have been going up, but the realtors group points out that sales generally are strong. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The gap between the poor and the middle class seems to be growing, and so does the inability of each to comprehend the other. My guest Gerald Ladd has written a memoir called Out of the Madness about what it was like to grow up in a vermin-infested housing project in West Dallas. His young mother devoted more time to getting her next fix than to raising her children. In 1989, when he was 19, Ladd was the subject of a newspaper column that described how he patrolled the project to keep away crack dealers in return for free rent. Ladd later showed some of his own writing to the columnist. This led to an article by Ladd about growing up in the projects, which was published in Dallas Life magazine. It won the National Essay of the Year Award from the Sunday Magazine Editors Association and was expanded into his new book. Here's a short reading about the place where he grew up.
The vast projects were divided into three groups, Elmer Scott, George Loving, and Edgar Wards, with a network of trails connecting them. Eight apartments were carved from each unit and numbered like jail cells. Made of bricks, they looked as if someone took a few old dirty chimneys, molded them together, and cut out windows. Clotheslines crossed in the backyards. Inside, roaches and rats roamed throughout the night in our icebox, closets, and beds. Spiders and their webs were in every corner. The toilets always flooded. We sometimes relieved ourselves outside on the ground. Hot water was rare. Didn't matter to me. I never took baths anyway. There was heat, but no air conditioning. Some families had fans that they placed in wide open windows to bring in the cooler air when it was cooler. Others had old-fashioned blow fans that stored insulated water in small water tanks, but most families, like mine, had nothing. On long, hot Texas nights, Junior and I usually tossed, turned, and sweated, unless a cool late-night breeze brought us temporary relief. We would lie awake sometimes, waiting on that breeze, but when it passed us by, we would toss and sweat all night. Then the heat would wake us early in the morning. Noise echoed throughout the units day and night, with everyone sitting on his or her porch when the apartments became unbearably hot. Radios would blare music, mostly blues and mellow jazz. Crowds of young lusty boys and teenage girls with their babies would gather on the corners, on porches, and in parked cars, but never too close to the dope dealers. Since there were few streetlights that worked, the dark darkness gave the place an eerie, wasted look. Teenage boys roamed through the three sections late at night to visit girls or the marijuana house in George Loving. Fights, rapes, and arguments were as common as the fear and grief that gripped this place.
That's Gerald Ladd reading from his new memoir, Out of the Madness. Gerald, your mother was a heroin addict. How old were you when you realized that she used?
I must have been between the ages of 7 and 11, and I realized it based on the observations of other children in the projects who had begun to call my mother a whore and a drug addict to my face, and use other unacceptable terms, what we commonly refer to as cursing. Your mother is a, for example. Also, when the streams of men to begin to frequent our household, the ways of smoke and the cesspool type environment. When I got of age and of mind and began to understand why my household was different and began to understand why the money that we received from the federal government and the money which my father was sending for child support was all disappearing.
One of the things that was really disturbing was that your mother was first turned on by her mother. It was your grandmother that gave your mother her first shot of heroin.
I heard the story from my mother when I asked her how in God's name did she ever become hooked on drugs. And she told me about the episode of her mother taking her into a bathroom and telling her, this is a remedy for a headache. I know something that will help ease your pain from the separation and trials you're having with your husband, who was my father, Paul Ladd. I know what will ease the burden of the tremendous odds of your attempting to survive and correct your life in the projects. And she showed her how to mix the batter and how to squeeze the clear liquid into a needle and inject the drugs into her arm.
And your mother told you that story?
Yes, she told me that story when I was a teenager.
Since your mother was a junkie, were there a lot of drug dealers who came to the house and brought trouble and danger with them?
I saw my mother on many occasions scared that someone would come into our house and kill us all. On several occasions, men would steal the little possessions we have. One tried to rape my sister, woke us up late at night, dragging a black rapist on our back. He had to come into our house on a night when my mother was out on one of her merry adventures and saw no adult was present, and attempted to rape my sister. So she managed to struggle and fall on our bed, waking me and my brother. And this man made us stand over at the corner and kept telling my sister to come with him out of the room for whatever purposes he had in mind. But my brother bravely stepped forward, and we were children like 9, 10, and 11, and told him no matter what he did to us boys, he would not harm one hair on my sister's head. We were very hardened then, and I believe if that man would have continued to try to attack one of us, we probably would have stabbed him with one of the kitchen butcher knives or hit him in the head with a hammer. We had been through so much, and we were so steeled that we were capable of that, even at that age, to preserve our lives. One night, I came to my house after playing in the neighborhood, and when I opened the screen door, this drug dealer kicked me hard between my legs on my private parts. He kicked me so hard it caused me to fly back through the air and land on the ground with a thud. Afterward, I had uncontrollable urination as I sat there watching him reaching for his revolver, and he pointed it at me. And I think I was between 9 and 11 then. And then he recognized me, and he did not pull the trigger. He was some panicky dope dealer visiting our house, and knowing the kind of danger he was placing himself in by dealing drugs, and inadvertently thought I was someone coming to get him.
You must have been so angry with your mother in spite of the fact that you loved her. Mothers are supposed to protect their children, not bring danger to their children.
Mothers are supposed to have fair chances in society. My mother was just as much as a victim as we were. When she was 14 years old, her mother required her to drop out of school, go to work, and to help with her six brothers and sisters. She cleaned, cooked, and washed instead of having exposure to the academic curriculum that would have cultivated her mind, or being able to play the nonsense games that little girls love to play. So, and mothers, daughters normally, naturally follow in the footsteps of their mother. So if the mother is not only being sinister and doing drugs, but actually leading, debauching her own child into the same habits, then the child is without chance. I compare my mother's experience like taking an infant by the feet and tossing it into the wilderness and expecting that infant to rear it herself. That my mother had the strength even to encourage us at the critical points of our life says a lot about the character of that she possessed and the nature and indomitability of the human capacity.
What made you decide that you didn't want to be like your mother, that you didn't want to be a junkie?
How could I have chosen that lifestyle? seeing the effects, having the primary evidence laid out before me, seeing the results of how it literally destroyed the black communities in the projects and other such marked communities. And I vowed at a very young age, if I did nothing else, I would never, ever become like these people.
How old were you when you vowed that you wouldn't become that way?
I was very, very young, very, very young, and but mature because of the circumstances. And I must have been no more than 7, 8, 9 years old.
So did you ever try drugs yourself?
Although I've experimented with marijuana for several months, I've never done drugs. I've never been in trouble with the law.
What about your friends? Did you watch them do it and worry for them?
Similarly, none of my friends have ever done drugs besides some casual drinking and smoking of marijuana, because each of us realize what that kind of habit and what the consuming of drugs and alcohol has done. We have primary evidence, firsthand observation. We have the most brutal kind of experience you can have, and that's to sit there and watch and see drugs and crime destroy people and destroy communities. So if one could see this, if one could see his sister fall into a hole and be consumed, why would he choose that path if he can apply wisdom? And not only why would he choose that path, but why would he not warn others of that danger?
Yet in your memoir you write that there was a time when you considered selling dope.
Yes, the considered and doing are two different things, but the odds were so monumental of one extricating himself out of that kind of abject, impoverished environment. I was starving, virtually, nearly homeless, looking for work 10, 15 hours a day, watching my mother steadily deteriorate, watching my sister and my brother hopeless, watching the police abuse our rights and beat the crap out of us, watching all the people in the complex where I was living losing hope. And at that time, I thought long and hard about selling drugs. I wanted to get in for just a spat and make enough money just to get some resources and go back to school. But I still chose not to do it, even though I couldn't buy myself a bologna sandwich.
My guest is Gerald Ladd. He's written a new memoir called Out of the Madness. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Gerald Ladd. He's written a memoir called Out of the Madness, From the Projects to a Life of Hope. He's 24 years old and lives in Dallas. There were times when you needed money bad and you'd steal or turn to one of various hustles for it. How were you introduced to doing that?
I was introduced to stealing by an adult whom my mother sent me to borrow a cigarette. And at that time, I was desperate for everything. So I asked this adult, I said, "Hey, my mother wants to know if she can borrow a cigarette." And I remember him looking toward the heavens, acting as if he didn't hear me or had not heard me. And all of a sudden, he snapped and he made some remarks stating that he knew how to help me get some money and to get my mother all the cigarettes she wanted. And you know what he did?
What did he do?
He took me into the house of some Asian Americans living in the projects and took me to their only thing of value, their TV set, and made me help him carry it out to his car and take it to some drug dealers who would take anything of value in exchange for their dope. And that was his way of giving me an example of how to get the things I needed for my mother, even if they were cigarettes.
So did you end up doing that a lot?
No, that was the only experience I had with doing that. But on days when my hunger would not let me rest, and days when I couldn't find work in the projects of West Dallas, I would go to the shopping center and steal sardines or bags of rice, anything that could quench that unquenchable hunger. And I also would take my brother, or my brother would join me, rather, and we would do things like that. But keep in mind, even before I ever even stole a bag of rice or a can of sardines, I would go up there to the store and beg the people to let me take out their groceries, walk up and down the industrial streets of Dallas begging anyone for work. I'm 13 or 14 years old. Any kind of work, sweep or hold a sign out in front of your door all day. But I had not yet met the age requirement for legitimate employment, so I was often turned down.
So your attitude was, if I can't legally find a way to get some food, I'll get it illegally.
No, my attitude was, I could not starve, I must eat.
Mm-hmm. You're very smart and you write very well. When did you realize that you had that gift? Were you interested in school?
I was always interested in school, but throughout my upbringing in my short 24 years, I've remarkably always witnessed and saw evidence of the capacity of humans. I've met many potential engineers and lawyers and doctors and philosophers, priests, just all of the various professions and contributions one can make to society and to organized civilization. But one by one, all of them were destroyed in one way or the other. All their talent, their ambition, their potential brilliance was snuffed out so thoroughly about the elements in that kind of environment. But I persevered, and I developed a love for reading, and through reading I got exposure to what I term dead literary role models like Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey. And one of my favorites is a Renaissance philosopher named Pico Mirandola, wrote The Dignity of Man. His work asserted that man is neither completely godly nor terrestrial, but somewhere in the middle, and that he can ascend to the highest heights or sink to the lowest depths according to his will.
Did your friends think that you were odd for reading that much?
Well, many of my friends read just as often as I. I know a lot of avid, voracious readers. So, in fact, my friends and I would share literature, exchange literature, debate on literature, debate on the theories in the literature we read. So it's a wrong stigma to think that most young people in impoverished communities don't have the desire to read, because they do. But the hardest thing ever in my life was trying to read or concentrate on school when I had a three-day-old hunger headache.
You know, in your book you write, a lot of people said, you're smart, you're talented, you should make something of yourself, but none of them ever said how to do it. So how did you figure out how to take your interests, literature, writing, and channel it into something, try to get published? What clues did you have about how to do that?
I developed the philosophy early on, after hearing these remarks so often, that you can do this and you must be twice as good as your counterpart, the white man, in order to succeed. But no one would ever explain to me how. It's always that you must, and you're talented and you're good, but how do I go about this? No one ever did. So I took it upon myself to seek out the rare mentors, which were mostly dead people in books, to get the examples that I should have been exposed to all my adolescent and teenage years, and my young adult years coming up, my young adult years forming my character, my young adult years forming my values. But I had to take this upon myself.
What kind of jobs did you hold along the way to make a living before you started writing?
Most of them were menial, busing tables, sweeping floors, maintenance, anything, any place where I could get hired and get any kind of income to supply the rudimentary requirements of you, just basic core survival, you know, housing, food, clothing, bus fare. I would work 15, 20 hours a day, store clerk. It didn't matter, drag myself home, walk 3 and 4 miles to and from work when I didn't have bus fare, I was just starting a job. And this is, in essence, the kind of desire I've seen in every person. But when you see them, when you hear about them through the media, they're on the end. They've done all this. They've given up. They're on the edge of despair, and they're saying, no, I won't do this anymore. I won't push myself to the edge, to the brink of insanity. I'm going to sit here and get some rest for a while. I'm going to go on a corner and get some camaraderie, some love, some support. And that's when the media in America depicts them. That's when you see them. And that's when you see the stereotypes. Oh, they're lazy and they're doing nothing. They're sitting there drinking, but they're tired. They've been struggling all their lives. And they know that within themselves, they have the capacity just like any other human, but they are being denied. And they're on the edge of insanity, so they're saying, let me rest for a while.
Where do you live now? Do you live in the projects still?
No, I no longer live in the projects. I still have several close friends there, but I still live in a community that's stigmatized here in Dallas. It's called South Dallas, and South Dallas is the, let's say, black version of a suburb. South Dallas has a diverse mixture of a lower class and lower middle class people, and it's very, very close to the central core of the spirit of black communities.
And what's your mother's situation now?
My mother's situation is excellent. She lives with me. My mother is fully reformed. Her capabilities are fully being exposed. She attends school now, GED classes. She's very active in church. She wants me to find a way to get her a drug rehabilitation center and design it around her theories, because she feels like she, from her experiences, is able to help people from her background. And also, my mother's very active and involved with her grandchildren. I can hardly get out of bed today without her ironing my clothes or making sure I have a good breakfast or taking my messages. And that proved everything to me, that she could achieve if she had the right kind of support and was placed in an environment where she had some resources. As soon as I placed her there, she demonstrated that excellent example.
What kind of environment did you place her in?
One where she had a house.
Was it a rehabilitation center or a nice house?
The environment was a home with a son who cared about her and some money in the bank, transportation to work and school and from the doctor, a house that wasn't blazing hot because you didn't have air conditioner in this hot Texas heat that often gets over 100 degrees. You can sleep comfortably after struggling all day. Just the very simple, basic resources she took and responded to.
Gerald Ladd, his new memoir is called Out of the Madness. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The great stride pianist James B. Johnson also wrote some phonic works, which were rarely or never performed. Coming up, we talk with conductor Maren Alsop about her new recording of these compositions. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new pop rock albums by the little-known but persistent band Shoes and by Freddie Johnston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Jordan and Israel have ended 46 years of hostilities. They've signed a declaration aimed at ending years of belligerency between their two countries. King Hussein of Jordan and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin were the guests today of President Clinton at the White House. Mr. Clinton says both men are heroes, and he called on both countries to honor their new agreement.
Now, as we witness the signing of this declaration and applaud the bravery of these men, let us remember that peace is much more than a pledge to abide by words on a page. It is a bold attempt to write a new history. Guided by the blessings of God, let us now go forward and give life to this declaration. For if we follow its course, we will truly achieve a peace of the generations.
Israel and Jordan will begin work right away on border issues, security matters, and water rights. The United Nations Secretary General says the Security Council should think about pulling all UN forces out of the former Yugoslavia. Boutros Boutros-Ghali says the Security Council should consider the pullout, whether or not a Bosnian peace agreement is signed. He sent a letter to the Council saying UN forces are too small to enforce a future peace settlement, and he points out that if there's no peace agreement, the UN peacekeepers will be in an untenable situation if airstrikes or other offensive action breaks out. In the southern Mexican state of Chiapas, already in turmoil after the Zapatista peasant resurrection, the opposition candidate favored to win the governorship there was seriously injured today in a road collision, which his supporters say was no accident. NPR's David Wellna reports.
An unlicensed semi-trailer whose driver is now missing slammed into a convoy carrying gubernatorial candidate Amado Avendano early today. Three people were killed, and Avendano is reported in critical condition with a crushed skull. The well-known publisher of a leftist newspaper was running as the candidate of a broad coalition of civic groups, and he was favored to become the first opposition governor ever to rule Chiapas. The collision took place in exactly the same spot where another opposition candidate was killed 2 years ago. Avendano's wife charged today that this was clearly an attempt to take her husband's life. It's feared that outrage over the incident could lead to further violence, with national elections less than a month away. Most of Mexico's political parties today demanded an independent investigation of the mishap. I'm David Malnet in Mexico City.
Rescue workers in Argentina say the death toll from a bomb blast last week in Buenos Aires is now at 80 people. The blast was inside a seven-story Jewish community center building. Jewish groups say 20 people are still missing. Authorities say they've given up all hope of finding any survivors. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 7 points to close at 3,741. This is NPR. A new Justice Department report says 1/6 of all violent crimes occur in the workplace. The report shows that 10% of the offenses involved handguns. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Justice Department compiled data for its report from 1987 to 1992, and it showed that almost 1 million violent crimes occurred each year at the workplace. Assaults on the job led the list of violent offenses, followed by robbery and rape. Though the report didn't cite the number of homicides on the job, other sources, including the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Center for Disease Control, placed a figure at 4% of all the nation's homicides. In the category of nonviolent crime, the Justice Department says 2 million personal thefts and more than 200 car thefts occur each year while people are at work. Experts say changing living and behavior patterns have made workplaces increasingly significant due to the amount of time people spend there, and crime is following those trends. The report says because of crime on the job, about 500,000 victims lost an average of 3.5 days of work per crime, leading to more than $55 million in lost wages. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A fish processing ship that has burned out of control off the southwest tip of Alaska was towed out to sea today. It's leaking oil and kicking up clouds of toxic ammonia. One crew member is missing. 132 people have been evacuated from the ship. The Coast Guard says the ship is not going to sink. Houston police say they don't have any leads on who stole a truck of U.S. Army band instruments. The load of instruments disappeared from a Houston hotel parking lot early yesterday. A sergeant assigned to drive the truck says it was found yesterday afternoon, but without its $500,000 cargo. He says the truck was parked in a well-lit lot, which is supposed to be guarded, and he says it was completely locked up. The band is made up of the Army's best musicians. It's scheduled to play in San Antonio. The show will go on thanks to replacement instruments shipped in from several other Air Force and Army bands. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James P. Johnson was perhaps the greatest of the stride pianists. His recordings are jazz classics. But Johnson also wrote symphonic works, and those pieces were rarely, if ever, performed. In the 1930s, it was difficult for an African American to get his symphonic works taken seriously. Now there's a new recording of Johnson's compositions for orchestra, featuring the Concordia Symphony, conducted by its founder, Marin Alsop. She's also the principal conductor of the Colorado Symphony. She comes from a musical family. Her father was the violinist and concertmaster for the New York City Ballet Orchestra, and her mother played cello in the orchestra. Here's the title track of Victory Stride, the symphonic works of James P. Johnson. Some of Johnson's symphonic works were performed in 1941 at Carnegie Hall, but when Marin Alsop started looking for the scores, they were presumed to be lost. With the help of Johnson's biographer, Scott Brown, she tracked down Johnson's family members. They initially wanted nothing to do with Alsop because they had been cheated over royalties in the past.
We started a very long development of a relationship with his family members, and fortunately they loved the biography that Scott wrote, Scott Brown. And that really opened the door to a dialogue, which and it was really a longer experience. It was more like developing a rapport and a relationship and a trust, so that Johnson's relatives and surviving family members could see that we weren't in it for anything other than the love of the music and the love of his writing and wanting to keep his name alive.
Why did James P. Johnson have trouble getting his symphonies played in his own lifetime?
It's an excellent question. I think it's probably a complex question. I don't want to minimize it. There are several things that I'm aware of. One is that Johnson had a very, very difficult life health-wise. He had several strokes, I think actually eight, during his lifetime. So as soon as he would begin to get some notoriety, he would be stricken with this horrible health crisis and have to recover for several months. And believe it or not, each time he was able to recover so that he could play piano almost as well as he had prior to the stroke. So his determination was quite formidable. But I think that really, that got in his way, obviously, quite a bit. There are a couple other things. I think you have to remember that many, many black composers of the time who wanted to write for symphony orchestra were discouraged from that venue. They were really steered toward popular music. So this is, of course, the prevailing atmosphere, and I think unless you had someone to promote your music, had a conductor, had a mentor, it was very, very difficult to get performances.
Let me play the opening of another piece that's featured on your new recording, Victory Stride, the symphonic music of James P. Johnson. And this is Drums, a symphonic poem, which he wrote in the early 1940s. Introduce us to this work.
Well, this is a great example of Johnson's ability to integrate different styles and to somehow bring together the world of jazz. In this particular piece, it's African drumming that he's really somehow, I think ingeniously, putting through the sounds of the symphonic orchestra. So instead of having, ethnic instruments at the beginning of the piece, he actually tries to simulate the African drumming with the orchestral timpani. And it's a great piece for the timpanists. They love the opening, and it's a lot of fun to hear because the more raucous you can be, the more successful the piece. And from this opening of the drumming, it goes into, I would say it's a cross between a hot big band number and really like the symphonic music of Ellington.
The Concordia Orchestra, which performs Johnson's music on your new recording, is an orchestra that you founded in 1984, I believe with $10,000 of your own money. That's something I'd imagine very few people do, is put up their own money to start an orchestra. What was behind that?
I don't know. That money was making me very nervous. I had to get rid of it quickly. So if you want to get rid of money fast, start an orchestra. No, I think it was really My colleagues, I was a violinist first and was doing a lot of freelance work in New York. And my friends knew that I had this aspiration and this hidden passion is the only thing I can call it, to become a conductor. And they would all come over and play for me here and there. And they were extremely encouraging. And I felt that I had taken advantage of them for probably the maximum number of years I could. And so I needed to formalize our relationship, basically, and I really needed to pay them for their time and their energies and efforts. And that's how Concordia was born. And also this love, as I mentioned, my love of jazz, and how do you bring that together with your commitment to classical music, and what can you possibly do? What kind of project would blend these two elements? And Concordia really grew out of that dual approach to music and that dual love for jazz and classical music that I have.
My guest is conductor Maren Alsop. Her new recording, Victory Stride, features the symphonic works of James P. Johnson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. back with conductor Maren Alsop. I know you took piano lessons before violin lessons. How old were you when you started piano?
I was 2, and...
What could you possibly do at the age of 2?
Really, I don't remember at all. I think mostly I sat there and screamed. But I retired from that career when I was 6, so that gives you an idea of what kind of emotional commitment I had to the piano. It was tough. I think mostly I... my mother claims, of course, that I was the next Van Cliburn, but I don't remember anything about it except getting hot chocolate at the recitals that we would play, which was my favorite part. So I think my parents in many ways were hoping that I would fall in love with the piano, and that would serve their dream of having a piano trio as well as having a child. So when it didn't work out, they were pretty disappointed.
Did they let you stop?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. I must say, when your parents are musicians, they don't let up, because they remember that moment, that critical moment in their childhood when their parents did not let them stop playing. You know, there's always a crossroads, or we all come to crossroads in our lives about these kind of things. And without some encouragement, kids, very talented kids, often give up the instrument and then they regret it later. But my mother in particular really did not want me to give up the piano, but we had, I think... our first major encounter around then, and winning that was an important important moment for me. But she got her revenge when I was 7, because they tricked me into going to summer camp, which ended up being Meadowmount, which is probably the concentration camp for violinists. And believe it or not, I fell in love with the violin through Meadowmount and my teachers there. And so she actually won in the long run, but mothers always win in the long run.
I always wonder what makes somebody think about conducting instead of making a career out of playing their instrument. What made you fall in love with conducting?
Falling in love is a good way to put it. It's almost stronger than that. It's like what I imagine when people talk about a religious calling, you know, that they had no doubt that they had to do this and it was inevitable. This is how I felt about conducting from a very early age, I'd say from about 12 on.
So was what excited you the stage aspect of conducting, or also the idea that you would have a score and would interpret it?
I think the actual conducting part was not intriguing, you know, or the idea of standing up in front of, 100 people. And, you know, I never thought about that part. I think it was more the idea of being responsible for the composer's wishes, that somehow I would be the messenger of the composer, you know, that I would be the, somehow have wings and be able to transport Tchaikovsky's ideas to the musicians, and mostly that I would be carrying this message back and forth. I always feel more like the captain of the team rather than the conductor. Just that my role is to really enable the musicians and challenge them to do the best they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And when that all works, it's just like an incredible, I don't know, it's like an orgy in a way. It's a wonderful, wonderful moment. And when you feel that Tchaikovsky is really standing there with all of you, you know, it's not just me, because no matter how much I wave my arms, no sound comes out. It's really the musicians. And if you can get a group of musicians that are just dying to do what they've been trained to do and open the door for them, they can work miracles. And that's really my goal.
When you started conducting, did you feel that your style was any different than your male counterparts because of things you'd been socialized to do as a woman?
That's a good question. I think about it sometimes when I'm specifically trying to deal with physical gestures, and I sometimes wonder if we as women have certain physical responses that we're, I don't know, maybe they're archetypal, I don't know if they're learned or just inherent behaviors, but I'm not sure if it has to do with being a woman or it's just part of my personality. But there are certain things, like when you, just physical gestures, when you have to give a huge fortissimo socket to chord to the brass section, you know, and it's all these guys generally, and here comes my inherent prejudice also, it's usually these big guys in the brass section, you know, you got to really lay it into them. I used to just, you know, do the gesture and then kind of retreat and as though I were saying I'm sorry. And I think this phrase, I'm sorry, I don't know whether it's part of the female role or just something that is particular to me. But I'm always trying to, when I first started, I was always saying I'm sorry, you know, whether it was gesture-wise or actually verbally. Someone would play a wrong note, I would say, oh, gee, I'm sorry. You know, just trying to smooth things over and make everything nice and take more responsibility. There aren't too many male conductors I ever saw who said I was sorry. But it could be just me as well. And fortunately, my friends in Concordia, my colleagues, you know, they come up to me and say, what are you saying I'm sorry for? Forget it. Get, you know, lose that phrase. And they were very helpful in helping me break some of these patterns.
Did you lose that phrase, I'm sorry?
I never say I'm sorry, even when it's my fault. No, I'm kidding. I try to only say I'm sorry when it really is my fault now. So, I did lose that.
What do you wear when you're on stage? Do you try to look like a male conductor in tails?
No, but I do wear pants just because I'm more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a beautiful Armani suit, which is just gorgeous, and I'm afraid to have it cleaned too many times. No, but it doesn't smell too badly, so it's all right.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Maren Alsop conducts the Concordia Orchestra on the new recording Victory Stride, featuring the symphonic works of James P. Johnson. It's on the Music Masters label. Here's Nightclub from Johnson's Harlem Symphony. This is Fresh Air. The heads of Jordan and Israel met today in Washington, D.C. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that historic meeting on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have a report from correspondent Ted Clark about the formal end to the state of war between Jordan and Israel, something short of a peace treaty, but a very, very friendly ceremony involving Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, and Jordan's King Hussein. We'll also have a talk with Robert Satloff, who's a historian, recently published a book about the history of the Jordanian transition of power back in the early 50s. He'll talk about the policies of Jordan and what accounts for them. Also today, Ann Cooper from the border between Rwanda and Zaire on refugees going home.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two of his favorite summer releases from artists that he says should finally get more than just critical praise. Here's the first recording featuring the band Shoes. It's on your face, there's no mistake. It's in your blood, it's in your veins. I've lost control, I'm on the floor. I'll cry for it. In everything you do, I stay awake, I can't escape. I've got it bad for you. Animal attraction.
I don't know about you, but one reason I like rock and roll is that I like a good melody bolstered by a strong beat. Verbal dexterity I can take or leave. When I want eloquence, I read poetry. It's always amazed me that in all the years since the breakup of the Beatles, so few performers influenced by the Beatles' sense of pop tunefulness have been successful. So it is with my men, Shoes, a quartet in Zion, Illinois, led by the brothers John and Jeff Murphy. They've been releasing their own albums since 1977 with consistent, persistent, obsessive excellence. The latest one is called Propeller, it's great. Chances are you'll never hear it on the radio. If all I had was you, the riches of the world would fade. With nothing more than you, I know I'd make it through. If all I had was you, and if you wouldn't stay, somehow I'd find a way. In 1979, Shoes got its brief big break. They were signed by a major label, Elektra, and put out two typically terrific pop rock wonders. When they didn't sell, Elektra dropped the band. Now, by coincidence, Elektra is giving another pop rock wonder a chance. Freddie Johnston put out a small label album last year called Can You Fly? It got great reviews. I put it in my year-end top 10. It didn't sell. Johnston is another Midwesterner with a reedy, plaintive voice. And he's made a second album that's even stronger than his debut. I suspect that a lot of rock and roll fans find the music of Shoes and Freddie Johnston on the wimpy side. There's now a generation or two of people who think rock and roll means Led Zeppelin and or Nirvana, and anyone working at a lower volume is a wuss. Well, I'm for a definition of rock and roll that's more expansive, more inclusive than that. Freddie Johnston and Shoes deserve your open mind.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Shoes' new album, Propeller, and Freddie Johnston's This Perfect World. I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk. If I could only give you everything, you know I haven't got. Suddenly I'm on the street, 7 years disappeared. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Rwandan medical crisis. We talk with John Sundin, a physician who recently returned from Rwanda, where he worked with the International Committee of the Red Cross. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.